And I noticed somebody put a crunch cream out at the back there. So I don't know if they overheard me last night when I said my favourite biscuit. Anyway, it was very nice. It was only one. I hope nobody minded. I took the last one. I also went to look for a chessboard, and there is a chessboard, but I can't see any chess pieces. So,
might be safe.
I might be safe, yeah. Actually, Lisa and Taya both said to me after I'd said that, they said, "No, Dad, just call it £100. You haven't got £1,000 to lose. You haven't got £1,000 to spare." So, mind you, on that weekend when I did it, I had no end of children come up to me wanting to play chess with me. So, and I've done it with my nephews and nieces. The problem is I've got two nephews who are very, very, very good now at chess because they're desperate to try and beat me to get this. I think I need to lower the prize pot at this point. One of them's just completed a maths degree at Bristol University and a very, very... very bright. Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to keep the incentive going. I think just 1,000 feels a bit much now. So, yeah. The next part is about getting equipped. I don't know if we use that word much these days. If I said, if you were going to equip somebody or talk about equipment, what comes to mind? School. What equipment? Oh, okay, school equipment. What were you thinking of?
Because I'm a teacher, so equipment.
Okay, all the bits and pieces. Okay, are you an art teacher or no?
Primary.
Okay, so bit of everything. Okay, equipment to enable the children to have a smooth lesson or something. Yeah. Anything else come to mind?
Walking. And kind of like going up a mountain.
Okay. So what would you need if you were going up a mountain?
Food.
Food, yeah. Plentiful supply of chocolate. Yeah, water. Yeah, boots. Waterproofs. Yeah, dress for the weather or the potential weather. Telephone for when you fall. Carol, the pessimistic walker. Yeah. When I was talking with Angela again, we thought, well, if we're going to grow, what is it that we need? What resources are available to us? And we were led to the passage of the feeding of the 5,000, which is a very well-known passage, I think. Is there anybody who hasn't heard of the passage or where Jesus feeds 5,000 people plus? No, but okay, everyone's heard of it. For those of you who grew up in a Sunday school, you probably would have heard it there. Would I be right in thinking? Yeah. Well, why do you think it's a well-known miracle? Because it's in every gospel. Yes, that's right. So apart from the very start of the ministry and the resurrection week or Passion Week, the events around Jesus' death, it's the only miracle recorded in all four Gospels. What else might it be well known?
Rachel's point is about food.
That's exactly what I was thinking as well. This is about feeding our stomachs, isn't it? Let's read the passage. If you turn to Luke chapter 9, we'll read Luke's version of it. We have a choice of four. Luke is not one of the disciples. If you remember, Luke is a doctor. That's right. And in fact, some scholars think that our Bible should be arranged slightly different so that Luke is the last gospel. So it should be Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke. And then Acts would follow, but Acts shouldn't be called Acts, it should be called Luke Part 2. So you have Luke Part 1, the Gospel, and Luke Part 2. So if you think of it in that context, because we'll be looking at a section in Acts tomorrow, which was also written by Luke, again, it's sometimes helpful to reframe these things. So as much as we believe that this is God's inspired word, we know that sometimes the arrangement might look better in a different way. If we look to Luke chapter 1 first, let's just have a little reminder. I think it's sometimes good just to, again, set the context. The very first few verses of Luke, where he explains why he's doing this. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who were first eyewitnesses and servants of the word. So he'd been listening carefully to some eyewitnesses' account. And therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. So take that as a reminder that this is why we even have the Bible in the form that we do. So it's partly so that we can know the certainty of what's been passed to us, what's been taught. Luke's gospel was particularly concerned with outcasts, with widows, with marginalized, more so than any of the other gospel writers. In this particular account, though, it's about a simple meal, which is the feeding of the 5,000. Some people say that wasn't the feeding of the 5,000. This is a joke, but the feeding of the 5,000 wasn't a miracle. That was just another name for tapas. You know, where you get the really tiny portions. It's a bit irreverent, sorry. But anyway, let's go to Luke chapter 9. And it's verses 10 to 17. Does anybody like bread and fish, by the way? Fish in a roll. It's not really something. Oh, wait, yeah? One or two. So, Luke 9, chapter 10, when the apostles returned, they reported to Jesus what they had done. Then he took them with him, and they withdrew by themselves to a town called Bethsaida. But the crowds learned about it and followed him. He welcomed them and spoke to them about the kingdom of God and healed those who needed healing. Late in the afternoon, the 12 came to him and said, "Send the crowd away so they can go to the surrounding villages and countryside and find food and lodging, because we are in a remote place here." He replied, "You give them something to eat." They answered, "We have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, unless we go and buy food for all this crowd." About 5,000 men were there. But he said to his disciples, "Have them sit down in groups of about 50 each." The disciples did so, and everybody sat down. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke them. Then he gave them to the disciples to set before the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. I was at a church in Bristol not that long ago. About a year ago, in the Methodist church at the top of, at the bottom of White Ladies Road. They had an art exhibition. Did anybody go to that? Angela did. Did you go to that? They have this amazing collection of modern art. And being an occasional painter, I did spot this painting, which really struck me. Let me see if it's... Where did it? There we go. I don't know if you can see that. Oh, it's not come up yet.
Oh, there it
comes. Oh, it will warm up. But this was a modern artist's version of the feeding of the 5,000. So the people are sitting on the grass, which we hear, which we read about. They're in contemporary clothes. Maybe this will help you relate a little bit more to the story. I don't remember the last time I had a fish in a roll, but I don't know if you've noticed, the artist decided to do fish and chips. Again, I hope you don't see this as irreverent, but just to help you realize what it would have meant for the people today. Like, if somebody suddenly said, hey, fish and chips for everybody tonight, I don't know about you, but I would enjoy that. Maybe you're not. But it might be a little bit, it might just strike us a little bit. They've even got ketchup, I think, on some of these. Anybody like that painting?
Yeah.
Yeah? Do you remember seeing that one? Makes it appealing.
I think the fish and rolls, it's okay. It's just food.
Yeah.
But that makes it seem like fun.
Okay. Know? Well, it makes it seem a little more real or a little bit more, okay, actually, yeah, a bit more relatable. So there you can see children playing on the grass and you can... see older people, younger people. There's even some there with bicycles, which is quite interesting. Some on mats. The one of the Gospels does say, in fact, two, I think, of the accounts say they were sat down on green grass. So these little details, historians love these details. They think, they believe that adds to the authenticity of what it was. And it actually is, if you look around that area on photos, it is a very green, grassy area. So I find it quite a lovely, lovely painting. So, what was the initial response from the disciples? Because so we've got this question or a challenge, if you like, from Jesus, which is, how are you going to feed these people? You give them something to eat. And they'd already decided that, or already found out that there was no food around. People had flocked to Jesus very quickly when he had tried to go and get some rest, try and go to an isolated point. So people either had been there a long time and hadn't thought about their dinner, or they were in such a rush to go and see him that they hadn't thought about their food. So what was their initial response? Anybody? By the way, can I just say, I love the fact you're knitting. what's your name? Sorry? Cicely. My mum knits a lot, and it's kind of, whenever I'm in the same room as her, it always just feels very comforting. And so I love the fact that you're knitting. It probably helps you concentrate, doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, well. Anybody else wants to get their knitting out? No. Okay, what was the disciples' response? Their initial reaction?
Outrage.
Outrage. Yeah? They were kind of indignant, weren't they? Yeah? Anything else? Yeah, so they immediately went into a practical solution. Yeah, they didn't really get an understanding of what Jesus was about to do. And I can't blame them, really, I think, if this was the first incident. Because there was another account where he fed 4,000. By the way, the 5,000, they have counted the men. It was probably easier just to, once they'd numbered the groups and so on. So we know that it's more than that, so it's probably something more like 10 or 15,000 to include the women and children, or maybe even more than that.
Much more difficult to count women. Some of them will be pregnant, they'll have children, they'll even be pregnant with twins.
Okay, fair enough. Easy to... easier to count than men?
They didn't have the resources, did they? The disciples felt they didn't have the resources. They only had five reasons we came to how we're going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, we'll borrow from John's Gospel at this point, because we know from Luke that that they only have five loaves of bread and two fish. Where, can anybody remember from John's Gospel where they got them from? A boy, yeah. So was this... How come he was the only person that had food? Do you think it was maybe his packed lunch, or maybe he'd been shopping? We don't know. Do you think he had offered them willingly? Do you think the boy? I think he probably did. I wonder if that's the faith, if you like, or the childlikeness that Jesus is looking for, which is, hey, hang on a minute. I know it's a big crowd. It fills a stadium or whatever, but I've got a packed lunch. I've got five loaves and two fish. Or if it was today, hey, I've got a couple of bags of fish and chips, and I'm happy to share them out. Whereas, I wonder whether the disciples were persuaded by the boy to at least present them to Jesus. What do you think? I'm not. I'd be interested in anyone else's thoughts here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen Jesus do other things, so why can't you do something with it?
Okay, so that's the boy thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, maybe the boy already believes that something can be done by offering up his packed lunch. Maybe the disciples had gone around, shouted out, hey, has anyone got any food? Because Jesus had been insistent that they were to look to see how they could feed the crowd. And as we've learned, the disciples automatically went into practical mode. Well, that means going to the shops, going to buy things, sending the people away. But Jesus had welcomed people. And even though Jesus was tired and had retired to this isolated place, he wanted to make people feel welcome, didn't he? He was compassionate. He wanted to listen to people. He wanted to heal them. No wonder people were flocking from the nearby villages to come and see him. Can you remember a time when you felt particularly welcome in a place? Either... Oh, well, I won't give any ideas because I'll just leave it open. And who was it that made you feel welcome, or was it something else, or was it the place? Anybody got any thoughts? Surely you must have felt welcome somewhere.
Yeah, I felt welcome when I came to the headlong.
Okay.
The first time I set foot inside the church, James was the first one. And they were
okay. Okay.
And that makes a huge difference to person on their own.
Yeah.
To be incorporated into the family of the church.
Mm.
Because you don't always get that in the church.
Okay. And do you mind me asking you how long ago that was?
3 years.
3 years. So even though it's 3 years ago, you can still remember that first contact with Eileen and Jane. I mean, that speaks...
It's the first time I've gone into a new church.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, Eileen. Yeah.
Hmm.
Of course. Maybe that's one of the resources that we need to think about, the welcome that we give to other people. This verse actually says that Jesus welcomed the people in verse 11. But the crowds learned about it and followed him. He welcomed them. He would have been that person that would say, yeah, come and listen. Come and be near me. It's an amazing resource, isn't it? I often think that the people on the door of the church, sometimes churches call it the welcome team, or the people, have the most important job at that particular point.
Can I share a very short tiny story of welcome? A week ago, we were invited to a bonfire party, and it was a family that we hadn't met before, but we knew a lot of other church people that might be there.
Yeah.
And it was a really such a beautifully laid out experience of an evening.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, we were invited to a bonfire party recently, and it was a really lovely experience with a lot of elements to it. Delicious food, fairy lights, big bonfire, fireworks. And I asked my daughter at the end of the evening, oh, Teo, what was your favourite part of the evening? And I was really taken aback because she said, Mum, the most amazing part of the evening was how welcome I was. And I remember the host, we'd never been to their house before, but how she took time with Taya as soon as we entered to talk to her and kind of get down on her level and relate to her, even though she was really busy and she was, you know, had pots of soup and lots of sausages to cook. And yet the fact that she took time for a 12-year-old on the entrance was made such a lasting impression, and it really struck me. Thanks.
It's amazing. Anybody else? Yeah?
I went back in 2019 on a trip to Venice, and on one of the occasions, one of the couple that we went with, Johnny just said one morning, right, we're going to get in a speedboat and we're going to go to the Guggenheim. And very quickly, we went up this canal. And we were greeted by an attractive lady with long hair to get off the boat to go into the gallery, which, to my, you know, I wasn't expecting. And I mean, she didn't know us. It's something they do, but it was just unusual because we just thought, oh, we're going to arrive, we'll get off the boat, we'll queue up. But we all got greeted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And those things really make an impact, don't they? And often stick in your memory more. Yeah. Anyone else got one last one?
We had a similar one over the summer. A lot of you know we travelled around Europe interrailing, and when we stayed in Croatia, we were staying in Airbnbs, and this one host, as we arrived, welcomed us very enthusiastically. Then looked after all our baggage. Then later on, they contacted us and said, oh, we got out for coffee. So they insisted on buying us coffee, and then they brought us bought drinks for us and bought us something at the end of the stay. Totally unexpected when you're basically just staying in someone's apartment and paying them for it. But in many ways, was the highlight of our holiday because we just felt so welcomed.
Yeah, they're amazing incidences, aren't they? I mean, when Lisa and I moved to Ireland, we felt an immediate welcome by the Irish people. You will have experienced it if you've been to Ireland as well. There's a real warmth there, isn't there? And we felt really like they wanted people to join in and be part of their community. So the welcome, one big resource. The disciples, instead, it's almost like they were telling Jesus what to do. Well, send them away, send them into the villages. But Jesus had bigger plans than they did. So this is the other point I'd like to bring out, that whatever plans we have, in terms of growth inwardly or outwardly, individually or as a church, I think God has bigger plans than we do. And I think it's worth remembering that. Jesus already knew what he was going to do, didn't he? He knew that this was going to be a big demonstration, which was going to be recorded by lots. It was going to be a miracle, which was going to be recorded in all of the Gospels. Many in the crowd would have been familiar with lots of the teaching. Most of people in Jewish culture were brought up on the Old Testament, especially the first five books, but also the prophecies as well. They would have been aware that there was there were prophecies about a time when the Messiah would come. And they're still waiting for it now. And he was going to give them a bit of a demonstration of that. There's a verse in, a few verses in Isaiah chapter 25. I'll just pull them up on the screen. Which some of them may have been aware of. And I think, remember, back to the Russian dolls analogy, a story within a story. There was a story some 700 years before in Isaiah where this is what they would expect at some point. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord. We trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. So this is something that the Jewish people, those people sitting on the grass with the fish, ready to have their fish and chips, may have been aware of, that one day God will provide a mighty feast. And again, we can see this story from our vantage point, and that we can see that this wasn't a parable. It was a parable of the feeding of the 5,000. I think it's called an enacted. Some people call it an enacted parable. It's one where Jesus took part in his own parable, and we see that when he broke the bread and the fishes, that we could see a snapshot of what it would mean when Jesus' own body was broken. But then we could also look back to the prophecy that one day there will be this feast of rich food for all peoples, which will be in at the end of Revelation, at the end of the earth. So there's a feast to look forward to. And here we have a miracle which happens, which, if you like, refers to all of those stories. Now, how would you like the look of that sourdough bread? I've been trying to do a bit of sourdough now for a while. I think that's probably, I know it's not particularly well shapen, but it's probably my best one yet. Anybody else do sourdough here? Yeah, one or two. Oh, we can share processes. Maybe I can get some tips from you. My family tell me that I need as many tips as I can get. Would that be fair to say? Sorry? It's not easy to get the consistent loaf, is what I've found, even though it feels like it's the same process. But I'm amazed by just the science of it, where you can just, for those who don't do that, just get some flour, get some water, put it in a jar, and the science does it itself. So the yeast is pulled out of the air into the flour, and you kind of keep feeding it with flour and water and discarding bits and things like that. And eventually you can use that as your, instead of a shop-bought yeast, again, just with flour and water and heat, and out it comes. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? And it feels like that. Do you remember when I was with you in August, I was talking about how the example of Jesus calming the storm was an example of Jesus saying, I am God. This was his deity. I feel this is another one of those, because there should be no surprise in a way that Jesus, who spoke the world into existence, spoke yeast, spoke flour, spoke water or wheat or grain into existence, spoke bacteria, whatever it is in the air. I'm not the scientist. Whatever it is in the air that makes this happen, it should be no surprise that he could then multiply 5 loaves into food for 15,000 or 5,000 plus people. And I wonder how many of the people sitting on the grass got that, they grasped that, that they realized that, that the God that they'd read about in Isaiah or in Genesis was actually here among them acting it out. I think it's another absolute statement for them. And that's probably why they were following him around. I don't think people were just interested in the fish and chips. I think they were, they knew who it was amongst them. There were lots of them. So Jesus has got bigger plans for us, and we're invited, aren't we, to trust him with it, whatever. So we might feel that our resources are fairly meager, that we don't have much to offer. But if we've got God, it's God that does the work, isn't it? And we are just the conduits of it, the passers on or the messengers. And that we only need to offer our packed lunch. If that's all we've got, then God can do something amazing with it, can't he? And as we mentioned earlier, it wasn't just the fact that there was a packed lunch available for Jesus, but also that it was offered willingly by the small boy. And I think that's perhaps why John includes it in there. Oh, by the way, it was a small boy that offered his 5 loaves and 2 fishes. So that we can realize there is a childlike faith. So this packed lunch, it was the small resources, the willingness was, it was like almost like a perfect background for which Jesus could do his miracle. And I think that's what we're asked to do today. That we're only asked to give what we can, give our resources, and let God do the work. So I think it's time that we have a little break and just have a little think about maybe what our resources are as a church. Yeah, I think, what kind of, maybe in groups again, if we can think about what resources has God given us, either individually or as a church, that we can use or that he can use to multiply or to demonstrate his work. Is that okay? So again, if you just sit around your tables, and then we'll get you back in a few minutes, if that's all right. Okay, if we can wrap up there. You will get a chance to talk more in a minute. I'll give you another question in a minute, then you can go back to it. Well, you've got Angela in your group. Do you mind doing the microphone around as well? Okay, how did you get on with that? Who would like to share something that they talked about in their group? Anybody? Oh, okay.
Everyone's probably bored of my voice. I've been yabbing this morning.
No, not at all.
So we were saying as well about the welcome that when Lisa was sharing about the welcome, I thought when you said, when have you been really welcomed, I thought actually when I first went to Hebron, it was quite overwhelming, the genuineness, if that's a word, that people really wanted to see who we were and, you know, wanted to get to know us. And the foundation of Come and See, the toddler group, was when Helen and I went to a meeting, and they were, someone had just come back from Africa, and in Africa the welcome, the word that they said to each other meant I see you.
Okay.
And I feel like in Hebron you feel seen, and I think that's quite unusual in the world, to be seen and to be heard.
Oh, that's so powerful. Do you remember the African word, out of interest? Anybody know the African word for I see you? But it's an amazing greeting, isn't it? Imagine if we all greeted each other with that. I see you. Oh, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? Yeah. And it
Hagar,
yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
It's okay. Basically, I thought of resources and felt like, and tell me if you've got a different experience of church, but feel like quite often church feels like a place you say, oh, I could do that. And then you get whooped in and sapped dry a little bit. See what I mean? I said it was going to be negative. but then I was also kind of reflecting that potentially it's just like a culture thing. We, you know, we're always busy, we're always hectic because there's too much on. So maybe it's not a church problem, it's a society kind of problem. So I was really struggling to think. The only thing I could think of as well was the example, the welcome example of that kind of multiplying. So I was just really, really struggling, yeah, to see where, like, the multiplication of it. And yeah, it feels like maybe we've got that welcome in the door thing. Perhaps, but like, yeah, I was really struggling to see, and yeah, it's negative, so I hope someone can turn that around.
Okay.
The thing is, you've got to be real, haven't you? If you're not, there's no point pretending. We want to be like Jesus, be able to access that power in Jesus. Otherwise, we are just being like the disciples and trying to do it all ourselves. So, you know, it's good to say.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes struggle with the word obedience, and I think in this passage the disciples were asked to be obedient. I don't know if I'm going to turn your answer around, by the way. Hopefully somebody else will have something better, but the disciples were asked to find what they could and to put the people into groups, weren't they, and then to also distribute it. And they, and I think they maybe at this point got an idea that Jesus was about to do something special. That may have been the reason that spurred them on. I don't know. But I definitely know what you mean there about we end up doing. And I mean, some people say, hey, we're human beings, not human doings. And sometimes it's just about being ourselves, isn't it, in a place rather than just trying to do things all the time. Lisa is often good at reminding me that, you know, we can be bit busy or kind of busy but busy fools sometimes. Yeah, go, Rachel.
Sorry, me again. Peter's set us off on a different tangent and said, you know, what would have happened if the boy hadn't offered his food? Would Jesus have just made food for everyone out of nowhere? And he could have done, but we were saying that what God really longs for us to do is to be in relationship with him. So we felt that it was all about the little boy giving all that he had and trusting that God did the rest. Mm. And I remember years and years ago, before I had children, I'm confident with little ones. I've taught them for years. I know what I'm doing. But someone at the front of the church said, we really need someone to work with teenagers. And I just thought, oh, well, that's not me, because I don't do teenagers. And then next week they said, you know, you don't have to be naturally skilled at this, because God can do anything. And so I said to God, if you want me to do it, I'll do it. And I felt him saying, yep. And I went, oh my goodness. And he did it. And every week I would say, okay, Lord, this is totally out of my comfort zone, but I'm giving you everything that I've got. Yeah. And by some miracle, it worked, and the children were engaged. And I just feel like it's almost harder when we have a bit of an ability. And because then we're relying on our own strength instead of saying, okay, Lord, I want to just do what you want me to do.
Thank you for that, Rachel. Anybody else got anything from their groups?
I think thinking about what Lou was saying, I think when you are working with God like that, it is actually hard work. Mm-hmm. Like the disciples, they had to carry the baskets around for 15,000 people and pick up all the leftovers. They even had to do the clearing up. I usually say I'm not doing the clearing up when I'm cooking. So, you know, I think I don't know what happened afterwards. Is that when they then got in the boat and went back over and they were all exhausted or something? I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah. So they did work hard, but then they had a time for recuperation. So I think we need to be in that kind of rhythm where we're giving out, but we can see the fruit of what we're doing. Because I'm sure it must have been really energizing. When God's there and it's hard work, it's a different sort of energy than when you're just draining yourself for nothing, isn't it? So that's the place we're looking to be, I guess, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Do you think the 12 baskets of leftovers meant one basket for each of the disciples? That they had
cooker's privilege, that's what I call it.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite humbling, isn't it, to think that actually this is how God does want to work, that he could work on his own, but he's not that kind of God, I suppose. That he is a God that wants that closeness that we've talked about, that that intimacy, and wants to expand his kingdom. He wants to bring others into a relationship with him, but in using us and using our packed lunches, the little that we do have, but the little that is offered willingly. Let's just go back in. I think we've got enough time. Sometimes I think it's good to try and see who we identify more with in a story. So, I mean, I think we've only really got two characters that we can choose, just to make it simpler. Do you identify, back in your groups again, do you identify more with the disciple or disciples who said, let's go into the, or send them away, go into the village, or we haven't got enough money to feed, you know, we'd need half a year's wages to be able to feed everybody here? Or do you identify more with the boy who, okay, well, I've only knows that they've only got a little bit, but they're willing to offer and they're expectant of him? So if that's all right, back into your groups again, just to discuss those two characters, if you like, or see which one you identify with more. Okay, if we can wrap up again. Okay, who... You got the microphone down there again? Yeah. Okay. Who would like to start us off? Who do you identify with more? Okay. Over there, yeah.
I must admit, I identify with the disciples because I see quite a lot of need living in Bristol, particularly in the part of Bristol where I live. And sometimes, you know, you get to a point where you think, no, I don't want to give. I don't know if I really like the people. Mm. And it's an awful thing, because I mean, I might always like myself, you know. But I've got, and yeah, I know this is not what you're supposed to be like. You're supposed to want to reach out and help people. So that's the worst of me coming out.
Okay, yeah. That's very open and honest of you coming out. Thank you. Anyone else? Go on then, Phil. Go on, Phil. Tell it like it is, Carol said.
Well, I think it was rather than us thinking, what should we be doing? We should be thinking, what is it that God wants us to do? And then step out in faith that he will provide the resources for that.
We didn't quite answer the question in that on which we would be, did we? But we were thinking about the balance between doing something that God blesses, which is kind of what the disciples would have done if they were trying to go off and buy the lunch, I guess, wouldn't they? But then you want to turn it around and be following what God's blessing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, God's inviting us to trust in him, isn't he, rather than do it ourselves. Yeah. Sorry, over to Peter.
I'm sure I was going to say now. I think we said that, you know, it's a bit of both. It depends on the situation, and actually we're all quite different as well. So, you know, there's definitely a tendency to try and solve a practical problem. Some of us are probably naturally wired more to see the big picture and to see the vision, and... But then maybe actually stepping into that is quite hard. You know, it's easy to sit in the boat and go, wow, isn't it amazing Jesus is walking on water, and I'd love to do that. Mm. And I think I could do that. But yeah. Then step out and be like Peter and get completely distracted by the wind of the waves. Mm. Whereas for other people, maybe it's harder to even conceive of doing it. But actually, once you're on the water and walking, yeah, Rach was saying about, you know, growing up, the experiences she's had of seeing God intervene in miraculous ways, and she there's the faith there to step into that. But sometimes it's not knowing, kind of, this is fair. to have that vision in the first place. So isn't it great we're a church where we've kind of got some of us that in some circumstances are more like disciples and some that are more like the boy with the fish.
Yeah. Okay. A bit of a mix of both, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. A bit of both, yeah. And yeah, it was God knew what he was going to do as well. He had a plan, yeah. Yeah. Anybody else?
There's something about resources generally. There's a risk of our table. When we were talking earlier, plugging a book. I don't know if I might have plugged it, had one before, a book called Garden City by John Mark Comer. I won't go into all of it now, but part of the thing that he says is God created the world out of nothing, kind of like you were saying earlier. Mm-hmm. But then he created people in his image with his spirit in them to use the bare materials of creation mm-hmm. and continue his work of creation. And so, yeah, to what we were saying earlier, actually, our call perhaps is to take the things God's given us and in his power, use them to build something new and to build towards the ultimate destiny of new creation. And so the scale of it, whether it is a few fish feeding and those feeding 5,000 or whatever, that's God's problem. But he chooses to use the things he's already put into the world, into us, and we continue his God-given work of creation through us.
Yeah.
Which I just found really, really helpful about, actually, what is our part and what's God's part.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really helpful thing to remember, recognising that all the resources are from God in the first place. If we have that ability to welcome people that we talked about, then that's because he welcomed us first. If we're talking about practical resources like food, he provided them for us. I've often thought of that picture in terms of painting as well, and music and shape. There's lots of things like if God gave us created the primary colours, red, blue and yellow. We can't create any more primary colours, but we can create so many different colours with those primary colours, can't we? And the same with musical notes, the amount of different pieces of music you can produce with the same notes that everybody has access to. We can't create a new note, though. I'm not a musician, but I'm assuming that's the case. Or a chefing, the amount of different new programs on the TV that come up with chefing, different things you can do with ingredients that God created and spoke into existence. It's incredible, isn't it? The range that we have. Yeah, I've often thought about that. I'd probably like to read that.
It's brilliant. Read that book. It's an incredible vision for all that we do, our work, our ministry. Actually, if it is in any sense creative, then we are doing God's work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I think the answer to the question is, to any question in a sense, is who are we working with and who are we working or partnering for? I assume that's for dinner. Lunch. Lunch, sorry, I mean, yeah. The who is the important bit here. Does anybody of you watch the traitors? Yes. Celebrity traitors. I was gonna guess there would be 7 or 8 of you because apparently 1 in 4 people in the UK were watching.
Wow.
Celebrity traitors. It comes down to me. It just comes down to this question of who do you trust, doesn't it? So a few of you watched it. So I think the outstanding star was the rugby player guy.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Who decided? You know, he got the traitors quite well. Yeah. And he had decided who his trust. Do you remember he said to that other guy, Nick, you're my 100%. I trust you. I call you. He called him his hundy. I think he said, you're my hundy. He was the person that he trusted, and they actually he betrayed him at the end. And actually, anyway, It's a really fascinating